Imagine a world
in which post-traumatic stress
no longer robs
from millions who suffer.
You don't want to get help because you're embarrassed.
That stigma of you can't talk to people, it is so true.
The experts, they forgot to tell me I can heal.
I don't want to live this trauma again. Right. And he goes, You don't have to. I said, What?
I just remember being able to stand by the water and look up at the sky and hear the noises. And I didn't think they were gunshots. I was like, those are Disney fireworks.
I don't even know what to imagine for myself now, my future, because have one.
This is Life After PTSD. Hello and welcome to another episode of Life After PTSD. I'm Ed, and with me as always is
Carrie.
And we have an exciting guest today who will introduce himself.
Chris.
Hey Chris. Good to see you again.
Just Chris. Just like it's from, just Ed.
Many thousands of miles away was the last time we saw you.
How many thousands?
About 7,500 miles, in fact, away from here. So
all the way just to see us. I mean,
well, it was worth every minute of it. I'll tell you, you guys are awesome.
Thank you. So Chris we've talked about Chris on the show before. Chris is who we visited in Lebanon when we were there. I guess a couple months ago now, in April. Mm-hmm. And so he's here back in the States visiting and doing Chris things here. Tell us what you're doing.
Well, the most important thing I'm doing is visiting y'all. So if y'all came 7,500 miles to visit me, I can return the favor.
Let's see. He did go see his mother too, which is kind of
very important.
That being that I'm a mother.
That is definitely more important.
That's actually probably the most important thing, right?
Yeah, every time we visit the States, I'm able to take a week with my mom. She's 86. So shout out to you, Mom, Donna Todd.
Very important.
Yeah, it's very important to give Mom a shout out. She's 86. And so my sister takes care of her full time. So my sister gets a vacation and I take care of Mom. It's a special time together.
So. Awesome. Very good. Well, shout out to Mama Todd in Alabama, right?
That's right.
If I recall correctly, I won't say the city. I remember some comments from some other people about the city. So,
okay,
where they are all from?
Mm. Okay, so moving right along.
Good stuff, though.
So today, let's see. We were sitting there, and you got some. Or this morning, first thing this morning, you got some texts, which excited me. Then we can talk about something else.
Yeah. So this morning, regularly I get texts from people, the ones that y'all trained while you were there.
Okay. Well, so the people that, with your help, obviously.
Well, I translated, but.
Important part when you're doing another language.
But they're still doing trauma therapy. They're still doing the messy technique right there in Tyre with Syrian refugees. It's happening. The clinic is open and they're still doing trauma therapy there. And so interestingly, acronyms don't translate well. So we actually call it in Arabic, al-alaj al-sariya, which means quick therapy because it works quickly.
That's so cool.
Love it.
Today it was a text and it was written out, like the protocol, like her handwriting. Oh, uh-huh. And he was like, oh, look, she even sent it to me. So I know she's doing it correctly or she's actually doing it. It was so fun.
That's great.
That was fun.
That's great.
It was fun this morning. So yeah, it was so rewarding to see people use so quickly, assimilate and use what they've been taught. And part of that is because you've been working with them for a long time and setting it up. And I know you prepared them as they were coming over or before we came over. But yeah, it was a really neat experience.
I would say this about the experience from our perspective. I had been working a year and a half training a lot of my folks in basics of trauma therapy and some protocols of trauma therapy. But all of us were impressed by the powerful, quick work of Messi. When we saw how quickly it helped people, we were all impressed by it. And that's why they're excited to be using it. I'll tell one story that y'all will remember. We had a young girl who is actually a daughter of one of our workers. And this young girl is from Syria, a victim and a refugee from the war like many others. And in the middle of the night, the secret police broke into her house. And her uncles and her dad, they bound them all up. They beat them. They put hoods over their head, carried them out and threw them into a car and took them away. And you can imagine a five-year-old girl clinging to her father, begging for them not to take him away, how traumatized. So she was afraid of the dark. She was afraid of men, afraid of policemen, soldiers, would not get in a car. And so y'all trained one of our local workers in the MESI technique, and she did it with this young girl. And right there in the trauma center, she was healed. She came out of that room a different person, praise God, and is now bubbly and vibrant and everything a young girl, 14 years old, ought to be doing. She's now able to have that normal life. And we're so thankful that y'all came and shared your wisdom and knowledge with us, make that possible.
Well, it was so amazing. I one thing I remember, if you remember, when she came out of the room that day, Ed was coming out of the other room across from her, not realizing, right? And of course, he's this guy.
Ed is a man's man. I'm just going to say it.
I don't know about that.
Look at that mustache. It will actually jump out yet.
Husky mustached man walking out of a toilet in Tyre, Lebanon.
Yeah.
And you know, I was like immediately protective of her, like, oh no, I'm so sorry. And he felt terrible. Like he tried to jump back, you know, and she was like, oh, it's fine. I'm fine. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I said, Maria, well, she didn't say names.
You know, she came up to me.
I said, are you sure?
Yeah.
You know, talked to the, and no, she was fine. She said, oh no, this is good for me.
She came right up to me and started talking to me. Hey, I'm Chris, you know, this and that. And she would never have done something like that before. It was like a totally new kid walked out of that room.
And what's so amazing to me is the brain wants to heal. It doesn't want to stay like that. It thinks that it needs to stay there because it thinks that it's keeping you safe. But when her brain, when she was able to connect the pieces of, wait, this isn't keeping me safe. This is keeping me miserable and not able to participate in life. And
you know,
her brain connected it. And then she was able to let go of that, which was amazing.
Yeah, you know, because I deal with people with PTSD all the time, that's pretty much what I do. Mm-hmm. And what I tell them is your body is using the mechanisms that it's supposed to use to react to fear and danger. What we need to do is convince your body that this is not the right fear and danger to react to and turn off those systems. That's what we really need to do. It's not that there's anything fundamentally not working in your body, but you're sending the wrong signals. Like,
it's overworking.
It's overworking. That's right.
Well, yeah, just in case. It doesn't want to ever be in that horrible situation again. So it thinks, okay, if I react like this, I'm going to keep this person away from this terrible situation.
Yeah, and I would say to anyone who's living with PTSD, don't, you know, get help. And MESI is a great way to do that. This girl that we've talked about, when she left the trauma center, she went out and got in the car. And the taxi driver, they always use the same taxi driver, he was shocked because she was always afraid to get in cars. She just got in the car. And he turned around and said to her mother, what's up with her? You know, she never gets in the car without a complaint or a fight. And she said, she just went through this trauma session. And the taxi driver said, I need that. I want it. When can I get this trauma therapy?
Wow.
It's the best advertising, right?
It is.
Word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's so simple, right?
It's right.
But it really is a reset for the brain. Mm-hmm. You know, I just think our brains sometimes just need a reset.
Well, and so your clinic in Tyre is continuing.
Right.
Is it expanding? Is it kind of status quo from when we were there? Like, what are the plans with that?
It's just open, basically, right?
Yeah.
Didn't it just, right. I mean, tell us about, I guess you had a good response of COVID, right? Because what you did during COVID.
Yeah, people say, what did you do during COVID? I got a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling.
Right. And then started a trauma clinic because you knew people needed help. And you kept praying for help. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, I can do this.
You know, if we really pray about something and it's like that close to our heart, we might need to be prepared that the Lord will do that thing with us and not with someone else. So that's really what happened. But, you know, to answer your question, we were really blessed to have y'all come and kickstart the trauma therapy clinic. Because
we are really blessed.
That was like our grand opening when y'all were there. And so the vision is really not to just continue what we're doing, but you use the word growth, and our growth model is multiplication. So we want to not just have y'all training people, but now me training people.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get to the point that we're all comfortable with what we've come up with, we want to have a training manual where people can continually train other people and have this be a movement.
Yeah. Yes. The messy movement. Yes.
The messy
exciting.
Movement.
I agree.
But in Arabic, it will be Harakat al-Ajl Sariyah.
Hmm. What is that? The quick movement?
That's the quick therapy movement.
It can be like a new dance move or something.
I still haven't learned Arabic.
I have. I'm almost fluent. I can say neem.
And you know, I think it's important for people to understand that that when the heart is broken, we tell people, you know, oh, you might need a stent in your heart or a triple bypass. People's brains can be broken, mm-hmm. and we need to fix those things that are broken, those psychosomatic issues, so that healing can occur. And we want to see healing in the name of Jesus. We want to see that occur in people's lives. And this is a step in that direction to prepare them to receive that.
Well, yeah, because just like when somebody, you know, leg is broken,
right,
and it stays broken, they can't function in their life. And while a leg is, you know, walking and talking, your brain is everything else, right?
Right.
Everything that's happening to you, you're taking in and filing and doing something with it. And if you're operating from a place of being traumatized, which makes sense that they would be, they can't move forward in a lot of other ways. I would think that it's harder. I mean, it's already hard to be a refugee, but it's even harder on the people who have responded to the trauma more negatively, I guess, or they've.
Right. Yeah. Some people go into this, you know, the war experience with a resilience that they're able to kind of live through it. Other people don't and are very, very strongly affected by it. One of the things that the refugees are going through is they really have two problems. One is they're war refugees, and they went through situations where they were under fire or you know, in the middle of explosions or rocket attacks. Mm-hmm. Then they come to Lebanon, and they have to live the daily life of a refugee, ongoing stress. So there's never a day where they don't have some misery in their life, some new thing. You've heard of that television show, The Wheel of Fortune? In Lebanon, we have the Wheel of Misfortune. Mm. So every day, something new comes up on it. Today, there's not enough food for them. Mm-hmm. Now they need gas for winter because it's cold. There's always something that refugees are having to deal with, and it's just an everyday new ongoing stress on top of the trauma they already have.
Yeah, and so, I mean, while we have refugees here in the U.S., it's a different circumstance in my observation compared to those in Lebanon. So they live in camps, refugee camps, right, in Lebanon, and it's kind of a little city inside of a city, right. And they do, it's a very autonomous somewhat as far as the rule of law and how things operate there. So like the daily life of a refugee, what is that like for them?
Yeah. So the daily life of a refugee, typically the father, if there's a man in the home, he may have been killed in the war or kidnapped, mm-hmm. and it may be just a woman and her children. But the men go out in the morning and they sit on the side of the road hoping that someone will come and hire them for day labor. And they might make $5, $8 if they get paid well that day. Mm-hmm. The mother, she has to take care of the kids, you know, all the work in the home. And typically she'll try to work too, especially in the camps. What happens is the women wake up at the crack of dawn and they go out in the fields and they work all morning until 2 or 3 in the afternoon just to pay the rent. And the rent is a piece of dirt to put their tent on. Mm. And so they'll work typically most of the month just to pay the rent for that piece of dirt to put their tent on.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think in the best conditions, being a refugee is challenging.
It is.
In the absolute best conditions.
You know, there are countries, Turkey and Jordan in particular, which have more organized and well-equipped refugee camps. Mm-hmm. That's not the case in Lebanon. It is every man for himself. It's the sticks and the plastic and the tires you can get together and make a shack for your family.
Yeah, it's amazing. But the people we met that come from those areas are amazing people that we were able to interact with and do our little part to give something to them to hopefully, at the very least, if they can have a little psychological breather. Just a reprieve from the constant onslaught of trauma. And I think, you know, you have all this past trauma, whatever they came from that caused mm-hmm. them to be refugees in the first place. And then that daily trauma that you're talking about, we can manage to kind of put in the right place some of that older stuff, which I think helps refocus how you deal with the stuff, the ongoing day to day.
Exactly. Carrie said something earlier, the brain wants to heal. That's so true. And these people want desperately to have some kind of normal life again. Mm-hmm. And so for them, it's wonderful just to have someone come in and sit down and talk to them and drink tea. It takes them back to this semblance of normalcy that they had before everything went bad.
Yeah, I think too, in talking to them, the interesting thing that stuck out to me, like when we have refugees here, often their goal is to just stay here and become naturalized citizens or whatever and work here in the U.S. A lot of the people I met there that are refugees want their country back. They want to go, quote unquote, home.
They do. And a lot of that is to me. A lot of that's infrastructure.
Yeah.
When refugees come here, they're coming to a wealthy country that has the ability to help them out and take care of them. And so although their new life is stressful, it's stressful in the sense of, you know, I do have an apartment and I can get a job. And but there are other life stresses. But the people in Lebanon and some of the other countries are hopeless. They really, that's one of the things they'll say, because when we do, you know, a lot of times when we do trauma therapy, depending on which technique we're using, we might ask them to do a future cognition or a future thought. What do you think your future looks like? And so often they'll say to me, I have no future. I don't know what the future looks like.
Yeah, which is a scary prospect.
Yeah. You
know? Well, and I think, though, in doing messy, sometimes they're able to clear the past and at least see, like, oh, maybe there is a future. I mean, there is a future. There is a tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
And if you can just hold on to just something positive in that day, I feel like that's one thing I saw, even though when we went to the refugee camps, I was pretty overwhelmed, right? Like, people are living here, like, with their children, you know? We have no complaints, right? But I think that I did see some of the people that process some things, like, notice, like, oh, wait, there are some, it's bad, but there are some day-to-day, small, simple pleasures. You know, like I did have enough to pay today, rather than... And again, I wouldn't want to be in that situation. It was definitely overwhelming seeing that, because you don't think about it when you're here. When you're here in the States, you really don't think about what's happening at that level.
Yeah, across the world. I mean, it's not just in entire Lebanon. It's many other countries.
You know, it's not just that they want to be happy. They have a need express joy and happiness in their lives. And so in the refugee camps, we'll go into their tents and they'll have dinner and they'll just be, you know, it'll be green beans. We're eating green beans and that's all we have. But they're happy and they're talking to each other and they're passing the green beans around. They'll get up and start dancing and singing because it's how they bring some joy back into their lives. It's what they can do in that moment to be happy.
Yeah. And so being able to mitigate some of their trauma, the past trauma, like Ed said, can hopefully help them deal with the day-to-day a little bit better, and then hopefully help them to move through it eventually. Because that's the other thing. You know, here we think of homeless or refugee, they're not educated or they haven't had a good life. You know, there's some really educated, very intelligent people that are refugees. And that was, I think that was interesting to me, or just, you know, to realize, like, these are people who are teachers and doctors and would do something, would be a completely different situation.
Right.
Somewhere else.
Yeah. Another thing that we mentioned, infrastructure earlier, you know, here in the U.S. and in other Western countries, we have established mental health care networks. Maybe they're not what they ought to be. I think we'd all agree there's a lot of room for access improvement. But when we get into Lebanon and countries like that, there's nothing. They have no access at all to mental health care. And so that's why I think it's so important that we're equipping people. We're going into a place where there's no access to mental health care and providing them with the best solution that we can come up with. So,
yeah, that's one of the things that one of the refugees said to us was that, Chris, you, were teaching them that it was okay, like that mental health is a real situation, right?
It is.
And it's valued, and you can look at your mental health and make it better. And that's okay. It doesn't mean you're weak. It doesn't mean, like, it actually means you're strong, because you're protecting you're dealing with your brain and protecting it and moving it forward, making it better.
It's an easy thing to deny that there's a problem. That's not the strong solution. The strong solution for someone with PTSD is to say, I'm going to deal with this. I'm going to do whatever I need to find help to get help and overcome this. That's what the strong solution is. And I, you know, we had a lady that went through our program and she said, I'm so thankful for this because I've had many shameful, painful things happen in my life that I can't talk about to anyone. But I love that I can go through this program and I don't have to tell anyone my shameful secrets and I can still get healed. That was powerful in her life.
Oh, it was so powerful. Yeah, that's so powerful. I was thinking of when Ed was in the room, like watching one of the people we had trained work with someone. It was a young man, right? And he was with a woman who was
Older than him.
Older than him. Yeah. And in that culture, I mean, even in any culture, like I don't know that I would want to see somebody my son's age for therapy, right? But if they can just go through a process, it's, oh, okay, I can at least do this. I'm here. I might as well try. And then, I mean, she had an amazing response, right?
Oh, yeah. I remember watching it and through the training, which was relatively brief, you know, we gave them absolutely the minimum of what they needed to learn this and know a little bit about trauma and, you know, do good work. I had picked up some cues of like to know where they were. I cannot speak a lick of Arabic. I think I know four words.
And give us one of
probably
give
saying
us one of your words.
Neem, is that one or neen or something? That's one of the something, right? Does it mean something? One of the numbers. What's one of the numbers? Neen.
We could say noon is a letter. Mm. Noon is a letter of the alphabet.
No, I don't know.
I don't know. I can't count for sure. Cannot count in there. Although I should, but I've listened to it. I don't know how many times.
We practiced marhaba. Do you remember that one? Marhaba?
That's like hello. Like a greeting. Right? Hello.
Yes, it is. There you go.
I thought there was an N marhaba. On the end. No?
You can say marhaban. That's a little more formal.
Oh, okay. That's, I think, how I learned it. But yeah. And then yella.
Yella. That's a great word to know. Yeah.
What's yella?
Like when we were crossing the street, yella.
That means let's go. Let's get it done. Come on. You know? We need some yella. Everybody needs some yella in their life.
I need some yella. I usually don't have to tell me either. Let's go. I'm usually like going.
Yes, yeah. It's true.
No one needs to yella, Carrie.
I didn't hear it. I didn't hear you. I was already up ahead
she's
somewhere.
She's the queen of yella.
I don't know. There's probably some other words. Shukran.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you.
Basic.
Good job.
This is like kindergarten.
Good job.
Kindergarten good job. Arabic for me.
So yeah. So you were saying you don't know Arabic and you were watching them and you kind of picked up some cues of where they were
and,
in the process.
You know, when we're doing it here in the States, we look for visual cues, you know, like does this person seem engaged in the process, you know, and you can usually see that through nonverbal facial cues and body cues.
Eyes, throat,
or their brows furled. And I remember this particular woman, you know, walking in and she just didn't look happy. Not that you should walk in, you know, you walk in, most people don't walk into counseling looking happy necessarily, but I was just like, oof, you know, and so then it, you know, the process began, I kind of picked up where they were in the process. And then like toward the end, there was a point where like a switch flipped in the wrinkles that were in her forehead smoothed out and she just started smiling a little bit. And then I could see her kind of like stop it on purpose, but he, you know, the person that was doing it just kept going and then it ended and she stood up and started trying to talk to me. which we, you know, between the person who could translate a little bit and, you know, she spoke a little bit of English. We had a conversation and I remember her saying, you know, nobody ever told me that I could think about happy things.
Mm. Wow.
And I, you know, to me that means a lot. Like, 'cause we're built to focus on negative. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the stuff all the time, it's even harder to just, you know, what was, you know, I played with my daughter today or, you know, just this little moment. I read the Bible, whatever brings you joy for a moment, you can sit on that even throughout the day when you're not doing it.
But, you know, it's so true. If you think about it, when something happens to your family or your, you know, your loved ones, mm-hmm. and imagine your whole people, like your country, sometimes I think there is some guilt. People feel almost guilty being happy or being, you know, I've talked to lots of people who, experiencing grief, and they said, oh, I can't be happy. Shouldn't be happy. It's not fair because this person's not here anymore to experience it with us, you know? And so I think when, you know, they're over in Lebanon and they know that they have loved ones or friends or whoever back in Syria, and they also know that they've lost things, mm-hmm. right? It's like, is it really okay to be happy? Like, is that okay? And I mean, I would say absolutely it is, yeah. right? The person mm-hmm. that you've lost or the other people who can't be experiencing that, it's not helping them for you to continue to be upset or sad. Anyway, but yeah, I think it's cool. Like, that's such a great quote, right? No one ever told me I could think about happy things.
Yeah. And probably, I would say almost daily, I've done some traveling in my life, especially in my younger years, you know, through Europe and stuff like that, and done some neat things. And in all of my adult career life, I've been in the service of people, saving lives, and definitely Tyre, Lebanon, I think about almost daily.
Tyre thinks same. About you.
Almost daily, if not every day, like some little thing reminds me, or I see a, you know, just a blurb on the news. And even if the news is negative, I go to the Tyre that I experienced, which mm-hmm. was absolutely amazing. And, you know, amazing people.
The people, right? It was, yeah. it was, I felt very safe. I don't, you know, except for on the way to the airport when I wasn't.
not because of the people.
Not because of the people, because I was sick. That's all. It had nothing to do with Lebanon. It had to do with bringing it from America, probably. No, but I felt, I mean, it was safe. They were just neat people. It was just a really
Great history.
And so willing. The thing that was interesting to me is they're just so willing to learn mm-hmm. and just try something new, mm-hmm. right? I think in the States sometimes I've tried this or I've done this. I don't want to do anything new. Or sometimes, not always, there's people that do try new things, but it was a freshness, you know, like and a really appreciation of, wow, I'm so thankful that you came here and did this.
Yeah, that they really, the Syrian refugees, because there has been so little help for them. When someone comes in and says, hey, we're here and we love you and we want to help you, that's so powerful to them that someone would just come and love them because they don't feel like they deserve it or that anyone would consider them worthy of it. Mm. But, you know, Jesus does.
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah. It was an amazing experience. It was exciting. When are we going back?
I don't know. We got to figure that out.
Yeah, we want you guys to come back.
We're taking Dr. Thompson and Dr. Casado to work with the kit to teach them play therapy.
Wouldn't
that be exciting?
They're working on a project for kids.
Yeah, Dr. Thompson's working on very specific messy for kids. I mean, we do messy with kids now, but she's working on
that
more specifically.
I'm excited, too, about us coming up with and I know y'all do group work, like that's kind of part of what you've done, but I want to focus more on group work in the future and really develop the protocol mm-hmm. To be most effective in groups, because that helps us reach the most people in a refugee Definitely. Situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I recently did a group. It was only three, but still it was a group of three, right? It's more than. And you know what's so interesting is they all had a little varying responses, all positive, but it was so powerful for them afterwards to talk about it. And it kind of increased the responses like, oh yeah, I did see that. Or I did. And they still, none of us knew what they had processed. So it was a really interesting experience. And we've done groups of, I guess our biggest group is what?
Oh, you had a group of?
I had a group of 10, but I thought we did 12 one time, 10 for sure.
Yeah, I thought 12 or 13.
We had a group of 10 that was, it was a beautiful, it was a really.
So let me ask a question, because when I describe us doing group work to people, what I always say is, everyone's really doing their therapy individually. There's just a group of them in the room. But I think what I heard you say is that after the individual therapy all in a room together, that you actually have a time when they share with each other as a group.
Well, you know, it's funny. We haven't traditionally. It just sort of happened in this situation because one person was so floored. So one person had been a demo. It was in a training. And so she had already done it once on her own. And then it was the next morning and they did a group. We did a group with all of them. And she was... and she was floored again, right? She was like, oh my goodness, I cannot believe what I just processed. So she was just, once we had finished, just processing out loud her relief. And it was obvious. I mean, she came in anxious anyway to the first day. She was not, there were some other things going on and she kind of apologized. And so this was the next morning and she had had this great night's sleep. And so we were doing it again. And she just said, this is like, I don't even know how you just did that. And it was in 10 minutes. And what? And so because of that, then they all started talking about what had happened.
And they were unrelated.
They were unrelated. They were not related.
So the bigger group that was done was a family. They were all brothers, sisters, cousins.
Well, it was from grandparents down to grandkids and cousins and sisters. And they had all lost someone and had lost someone and they could not, one person could not go back in the home where the person had passed for, it had been, I think, 4 years.
Wow.
And so we had processed with just her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she went to the home, gathered all the family because she was the most senior kind of the family. And they all gathered together and we did it over Zoom.
Wow.
And it was amazing.
It was you know, amazing. It's funny because when you said that, it really struck a note with me because Kim and I had talked. And for those of you who don't know Kim, my wife, she is the brains of our operation. I am the arm candy. She's the she's the brains.
The arm candy.
So we were actually talking about how we felt like group work maybe needs to involve some community building of like letting them go through the messy program together as a group, doing their individual therapy, but then let them continue on in some group work that's more actual social interaction between the people in the group. So I'm glad that you had that experience because that tells me that maybe that's something we need to look forward as a follow-up. You know, we always think, okay, we've done this intensive treatment. Now what do we do for follow-up?
Yes. Yeah.
And I think we've said that on the show before and in the class, you know, this is, while this is a short, quick protocol, there still needs to be some follow-up typically, like, and it doesn't have to be messy every time. Like we typically intersperse kind of traditional talk therapy, in between that. And then as things come up, then you use messy to kind of target, you know?
Right.
Messy is the sniper.
Yeah. I think, I would love to see, I think Kim would be great at doing it. I'm going to say
her calling in life is to be a detective. She is Sherlock Holmes. She is the person he wished he could be.
Well, I mean, messy is partly detective work,
it
right?
It is. Yeah.
Finding out, because what's bothering us today isn't often what's really bothering us, right? And so that's what's so fascinating to me. We may think we know, and that's part of what happened in the group is the one person who thought she knew. Oh, I know I'm having this issue, but it's from this thing that happened to me. And when she did the process, she realized, oh my goodness, it was something else that I knew happened, but I didn't know it was that big of a deal. But that's when my brain started thinking differently about life.
That happens. So I know y'all have had the same experience, but as I've done messy with people, so often the thing they think is their traumatic event, when you say, when have you felt like this in the past? They can always name an event. And okay, like 12. Okay, yeah, I was 8, 4 or 5 years old. You know, just a few weeks ago, I took a client back to the age of 4, the first time that he had ever felt this feeling and worked forward from there. And that was when it really helped
and
to go back that far.
And when I first started doing therapy, okay, if somebody had told me this, I was like, please, just stop. Let's just deal with behaviors today. Come on. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. Like, I just didn't understand the whole, the body keeps score, right? Like there are things that happen to you and we hold them in our body and they, we respond differently because of what's happened to us in the past. And I don't, I need to look up the statistic, but I've heard that if you take 10 people, right, mm-hmm. statistically speaking, that two, and they all experience a, the same traumatic event, two of them will develop PTSD, two will not. And then the other six in between will all be of varying degrees.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And that does make sense, right? And mm-hmm. And it depends on all kinds of things. I mean, could be depend on the way they interpreted something as a child, or something horrible happened to them, you know, and so they're not, what we were talking about earlier, like why some people go through it and they're more resilient than others. And it's interesting.
Well, yeah. I think, yeah, I think that goes back to what Chris was saying with the person he had that went back to 4 years old. Well, the trauma you experienced as a teenager or an adult or whatever, beyond the age of four, you're not, while you're experiencing that new thing in the present, it's really just repeating the original trauma in your brain.
You're re-experiencing, yeah.
I was telling you earlier today about an article that I had read about how childhood trauma can affect how you experience trauma the rest of your life.
Undoubtedly.
And you know, two of the examples they gave is as a young child where you may be bit by a dog or run over by a car. The person I was talking to you about had had both of those things happen.
Yeah.
Wow. And so when those past events.
Wow. She's really unlucky, lucky. I'm not sure. Like that's how does that happen to you? Both things happen to one person.
And so, you know, those things change the filters that you use to process everything that happens to you after that.
Yeah. I mean, I believe we are born with some very general and generic like programs in our brain that God kind of sticks in there. But really, you know, it's as you start watching the world around you, how your parents and how other important people in your life respond mm-hmm. to things and how they respond to you when you respond to things all plays that role of creating the original filter. And then whether that filter gets cleaned out or just packed onto through life.
You know, if you've watched your kids when they're very young, when they trip and fall, the first thing they do is look at you mm-hmm. because they want to know how big of a deal was this? Mm-hmm. How do I react? And so if we as parents go, and we scream and we get hysterical and run up, they're going to start crying, right? But if we're like, hey, you all right? Get up, dust it off, you know.
Yeah, rub some dirt in it.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I was really good with my kids doing that. But the other day, my grandbaby fell. Well, actually, he was kind of dropped. Well, he was set down and it was like the curb was there. And so he sort of like fell down the curb and he was fine. I mean, he was fine. But I was, I don't know, a few feet away and I went to dart to like pick him up. I just like picking him up too, right? And my son stops me. Mom, do not make a big deal of that. Leave him. And I was like, well, you could at least pick him up a little bit. I mean, like help him up. I mean, he's crumpled in the curb.
Yeah.
But yeah, he kind of looked at me and, you know, was fine. You know, brushed it off.
That makes sense because, you know, with our kids, we want to make sure they eat right. So we're like vegetables and, you know, but if it's grandkids, it's like, here's some ice cream and lollipops, you know.
I can't wait.
Yeah. Me too.
Yes. Yes. Just recently he was crying the other day and I was like, do you need me to hold you? And his mom was sweet. She gave him to me. I was like, so sorry they're being like that to you. I mean, he's young enough, he doesn't know yet what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, yeah. So,
and luckily my son and daughter-in-law are humoring me for the moment. So. Yeah. But yes, grandchildren are fine. I recommend them to everyone.
I have to ask, what's your grandmother name?
I don't have one yet. Do you know? Did you know that?
I did not know you don't have a grandmother name. You need to be a Nana, I think.
My mom's a Nana.
My mother-in-law is a Nana, and my mother-in-law is amazing. Like I could not live up to her like a Nana. She's perfect. So
if you were from the mountains of North Alabama, you'd be Maw-Maw.
Oh, there you go.
You're welcome to borrow that from us if you want. Maw-Maw. Or Meemaw even. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
I had a Graham.
I think I just want to be like, they had suggested Zippy at one point.
Kim's going to be Tata.
Tata
is the Lebanese grandma. Tata.
Oh, yeah, that's a good
one. Kind of cute.
I like that.
Could I borrow that from Kim?
Sure. She wouldn't care. Yeah, spread it around. Tata, kinda everybody.
Cute. We should have our first poll. Like, what should the grandma name be on our
what
podcast?
Is Carrie's grandma name? Yeah. Call in your vote now.
So I'm not that picky about it, but my husband, they were going to name, I can't even remember what they were saying, but he got very upset about what the other cousins were saying they were going to call him. I don't even know what it is because I put it out of my head because I told them he's not going to be called that. So he needs a name too. We're both sort of nameless. So we just sort of... Although I will say it might be that we just are called like a dog because... Our grandbaby, they taught him to call the dog. Like at the house, and so he came over a couple weeks ago, and he's motioning to me to come here, and then he looks at me and he goes, and I was like, oh.
And of course you ran right over.
Of course I did.
And yeah, you ran right over. Oh boy,
it worked.
I think this is called conditioning. Yeah, I learned about this in school.
It was so funny. I mean, it was, and if you know how much his mom, well, both of them love dogs, it was just it was priceless. I was like, this is hilarious. That so he was calling everyone like that. They've now narrowed it to just the dog.
Well, like the no noise in Arabic or in Lebanon, I don't know if it's in all of the that they told us. I can't do it very well, but
yeah, so it sounds like
what
this
is no? Oh my.
And you like yeah flip, and you flip your head backwards back.
Yeah.
In English it is the same motion we use for come here.
Yeah,
so like that thing for come over here. This means no.
Yeah.
It's a little confusing sometimes. Yeah.
It's interesting that body language would be different because, I mean, some of it is the same. Disgust, happiness, sad.
I think that's like an overt motion, so it's not unconscious body language. I think unconscious body language is pretty, from what I've read, is pretty standard across the world.
Yeah, so this thing shaking, this means nothing in Arabic. There's no significance to it. And they don't nod yes, they just go, like nod their head forward.
Yep.
That's so interesting because you would think that some of those things we just all do, but it's it's conditioning, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And as we
I was going to say, where do you want to go next? Like, what's the next step for you with Messy and how can we help you and what?
Yeah. For the people listening.
Yeah. What can they do to help you and, if they want to come over there they want to give money to help the Syrian refugees.
Yeah. So great question. Our next step is really more Messy. But we want to see it happen in more places with more people. That means more training. So we're looking forward to working in Syria. I already have contacts in Syria to go there and train people. We're going to Ukraine, which is a little out of my normal theater of operations. And also Egypt and Iraq. I don't even think I've even talked with either of you about a group
exciting.
In Iraq that wants to learn Messy.
That's so exciting.
They're thinking of sending some folks to Lebanon to learn it, and then I'd like to follow up by going there. So we're looking to make it something that's all around the Middle East, to have a movement of people who are trained and also training other people. And so if someone wants to help with that, if you happen to be a very well-trained Messy therapist and you want to come and... You know, I can a couple of names pop into my mind. You want to come and train more people? That's great. For people who feel like I would really love, you know, to see more people get healing from PTSD, from anxiety, from depression, and you want to help, we have a 501c3 charitable organization, and it's called Words of ISA, WordsOfIsa, .com or .org.
And we'll put that in the show notes. We'll put in the show notes too.
Yeah, they could go there, and that will give them directions on how they could contribute if they want to be a part of that. And we do like PayPal. There's all sorts of good ways to.
And we can link that. We can link that from on Life After PTSD too. We can put that as a link.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for your page. Well, Chris, thank you for traveling 7,500 miles to come visit us and talk with us here on the podcast. And so with that, for those listening, please share this with someone in your tribe. You never know who might need to hear this today. And thank you, Chris, again for coming and joining us.
Yes, thank
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Carrie. I'm just returning the favor. Thank y'all for coming to Tyre. Yeah. And
we'll be back to Tyre, I'm sure.
Definitely. Let's.
And maybe other places. Who knows? Thanks. Bye.